This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Yesterday on the show, we looked at ways that child support is adding to the financial burden faced by many black fathers in Milwaukee. UWM social welfare professor and Real Talk contributor David Pate says it's a kind of debt that can't easily be resolved. Today, our conversation continues. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce welcomes back David Pate, as well as Dr. Gabriella Sandoval, Director of Policy and Research at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in California. She's worked on a national project on the needs of low-income fathers with Nino Rodriguez, who is the Program and Policy Specialist at the Center for Family Policy and Practice in Madison. Rodriguez explains why black families are so disproportionately impacted by the issue.
Part of the reason is because if a parent who has kids who's poor, they sign up for cash assistance. So here in Wisconsin, you know, that's the W-2 program. Other states, it goes by different names. It's temporary assistance for needy families. The reality is when you break down by race and ethnicity, who participates in those programs? And we already know that black families in particular experience high rates of poverty. In the caseload of W-2 in Wisconsin, 52% of families are black, right? That compares to, you know, what's the population in Wisconsin of families with children? It's only 7%. It's a huge, huge disparity. So you got more than half of families who are participating in the welfare program are black. And when you participate in the welfare program as the custodial parent who's living with the children, you have to cooperate with child support enforcement to establish an order in order to get, partly it's motivated by this whole notion of cost recovery. We want to be able to get child support payments, one, to reimburse the state for the expense of the benefits that the parent and the children have gotten. So when the fact is that you have such a high rate of participation in the cash welfare program among black families, and because of the requirement to participate in child support, black men, non-custodial parents, are going to be much more likely to have this debt, to have a debt both to the other parent as well as a portion of it owed to the state.
Would the conversation around child support be different if it were a bigger issue for white families in this community?
Well, you know, the whole conversation around child support started with white families, with middle-class white women. It started in with UW, with Madison, with people there really talking about how do we get men to who leave their families and start a new one. How do you get them to provide child support? So it started from a middle-class space, particularly a white middle-class space. And what has evolved into in 1975 and more as we moved along to 1996, an issue around how do we deal with this issue of increased TANF or welfare roles, AFDC roles, and having the taxpayer not be burdened with this cost. So it's very complicated, and I think there'll be a very different discussion, but what's ingrained in our structural circumstances around economic security currently is that white families are able to get jobs. Not all of them, but from the research I've done and from what I've seen, they're able to get a job pumping gas, to being an electrician, to being a lawyer. There's a social network that allows for their social mobility that's in place and ingrained in our structure of our society. So it would be different. True, I do think it would be different. But also we have seen nationally more white families are on using welfare and are part of this, but they're still able to have the resources to not get to the point where they may be incarcerated, even though there's been places where you see that. I'm not saying anything's absolute. I just think that because poverty is so much more racially biased, I mean, poverty is just racially, I mean, that's just the truth. And I think that we have to figure out how do you deal with this disparity? Because it is very clear that this particular policy and how it's tied to poverty has certain outcomes for black families that are very different or families of color that are very different.
The other thing that's incredibly entrenched in our culture is marriage as an institution. And when we know, for example, that the majority of people who do get married are white, are middle class, and so what does that mean for families and parents who are not married? So, for example, if you do have a couple who is married, the man in that family may not be contributing financially to his household at all, and no one is going to come after him for that. And so there are these other kinds of cultural institutions at play here that kind of stack the deck against particular groups of non-custodial parents, of parents in general.
The reality, too, is for lower-income families, one thing that we know is that particularly when a first child is born during those first few years, and this is something that came out through a study called the Fragile Families Study, contrary to the stereotypes that had existed up until maybe about 10 years ago, although I think if you get outside of the academic community, the stereotypes probably still exist for most people, unmarried couples, half of them are living together, you know, and oftentimes what we see talking to fathers in our focus groups, it's no surprise to us, and it's the story hasn't changed in probably decades. A lot of times, a guy with a child support order will still be living with his kids, with the mother of his children. In a way, depending on the situation, you could kind of think of it like if he's got a job and if he's able to pay, the money like kind of goes out, does a little dance through the system, and comes right back. And that happens, I think, more often than people would care to talk about, because it's when we think about, well, what's a just system, that doesn't seem like what you would imagine. And then when you throw in the variable of is the family also participating and getting cash benefits through a program like W-2, a portion of that money that the parent is paying into the child support system, right, is getting held onto by the state. So if the family is all living together in the same household, that's actually money that's just – that's going out from the household.
That they're not getting.
Right.
One thing that hasn't been highlighted yet that I think is incredibly important is also has to do with the amount of wealth that some communities have access to that others don't. And that wealth, as opposed to income, creates a kind of safety net for some families. So, for example, white families are far more likely to have intergenerational wealth, especially in the form of home ownership, where they can pass down wealth from generation to generation, and that wealth creates a kind of barrier against kind of economic catastrophe, if you will. So if there is a white father who all of a sudden finds himself with this, you know, facing down this massive debt, facing incarceration because of it, his family is likely to have access to resources in terms of wealth that black families just simply don't have access to because of the ways that intergenerational wealth and policy around this intergenerational wealth has existed throughout our history. So in that sense, families of color, black families in particular, are less likely to have the types of resources to draw on when faced with a crisis of debt of any kind, but in particular with this type of inescapable debt, they just don't have that same kind of barrier to that type of economic catastrophe.
Well, and I would imagine, too, that if a non-custodial father is going into debt over child support issues, that this isn't just impacting him. You know, you mentioned that intergenerational effect. I would imagine that it would then trickle down to the rest of the family, that it would, in fact, affect his kids. It would even affect the mom.
I think that's a really good point and a good observation. And, Gabrielle, I'm going to let you, because you were the one who really pulled this up. What I've been seeing in my own work is that there was this issue around who was going to pay the order if he's incarcerated, because it still accumulates when you're incarcerated, or if he's just out of work, it still accumulates even though you have zero income. And so other family members from an aunt to an uncle to a grandparent can come in. And Gabriella, you've been really looking at this more with in your shop. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. I mean, in fact, I think as someone new to this work, I think the main kind of issue that stands in stark relief for me is the inescapability of this debt and the incredibly far-reaching implications it has with respect to wealth building. So in two ways in particular, these two situations tend to be somewhat intangible and oftentimes invisible. So one is the kind of ongoing in-kind support that families provide for men who are unable to either subsist on what's left after child support has taken their cut, after the state has taken its cut, after, you know, they've paid their child support. So if they are not the $36,000 man that Nino mentioned earlier, then that means that they are then having to look for other ways to support themselves. And often they're living with family members, they're living with new partners or girlfriends, they're living with friends. And that means that those people in their community now are paying in kind, whether that be by providing food or shelter or other types of support, that those people could, in their communities, in their families, could be using to save for their own retirement, for their own asset accumulation, what have you. So in some ways, that child support becomes a drain in that way. The other way is in large sum amounts, and we often see this. These are less kind of ongoing and more kind of one or several times over the course of the life of this debt. And this tends to be when a man is facing incarceration and is you know, has to pay a large lump sum. So we came across this quite a bit in our research where grandmothers took out, say, a second mortgage on their house in order to be able to keep their grandsons out of jail. Or other family members drew on their savings in order to make sure that these men didn't go to jail. Which, and of course, this has kind of these ripple effects in terms of if this man does go to jail for his child support debt, then that makes him less employable. Then it creates this whole entangled situation that is harder and harder to get out of. And that, in fact, does drain the wealth resources of their families, of their partners, even the mothers of their children, of new partners, of their communities in general, because you have a whole network of people who are either participating in this man's ongoing survival or helping to make sure that he, drawing on their resources to make sure that he remains able to even participate in the labor force at all.
Nino, is this what you're hearing from fathers here on the ground?
I wanted to share maybe, if I could, a quote from a father that we spoke to. And partly why I want to share this quote is to give people an idea of, well, what do people end up going to jail for because of child support? And in this father's case, I'll read you the quote. He said, "I went to jail and it really affected me. It just put a stain on me. I was out looking for a job." He went to apply for a job at the local police department and didn't know he had a child support warrant out. So when they processed his application, it came up and they arrested him while he was sitting there waiting to talk to them about his job application. Anyway, he goes on to say, "You know, I spent 30 years. I've never been arrested. I never got in trouble. And now there's this one instance with child support. I go to jail for 2 days. When I went to court, the judge, she was about to lock me up for 90 days. She says, 'Well, how much money do you have right now?' And I'm like, 'I don't have nothing right now. Like, the reason I'm here is because I'm unemployed. I was looking for a job, you know.' So she's like, 'Oh, well, you're ordered to pay $1,000. I could put you in jail for 90 days. And I was like, 'You're going to put me in jail for 90 days? That's not going to help anything. I'm out here looking for a job. And the only thing that saved me, I had an interview that next Thursday.' So she was like, 'Well, come back. Let us know about how that job goes.'" And kind of the point that I really wanted to make out of that was, we're going to put somebody in jail for 3 months because they couldn't come up with $1,000. So I'll let our listeners out there think about that.
I mean, and the thing about that, when I've talked to a variety of people around this issue of incarceration nationally and as well as locally, you know, it costs $144 a day to keep someone in jail. And that's more, way more than $1,000 you're asking for that the taxpayer is going to be paying, when I'm sure many taxpayers would say, let's get this person a job, and that way they can be contributing to their child. It can make our community better. It's less of an economic burden on all of us. And most people would want to do well.
Let me say, David Pate, Nino Rodriguez, Gabriela Sandoval, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Real Talk contributor David Pate is an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM, and he's the founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice. Nino Rodriguez is the policy and program specialist there. Dr. Gabriela Sandoval is director of policy and research at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in California. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. A quick break now, and in just a moment, the second wolf hunt gets underway in Wisconsin and gets a lot of attention from a variety of researchers. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.